Hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini with the Go See Talk podcast experience. Sitting in my driver's seat. No, I'm in the driver. Co-host seat, navigator seat is Federico Furzon. He's my radio intercept officer. He is my compadre. He is my good friend from Buenos Aires. How are you doing today, Federico?
I'm okay. It's been a hell of a Friday, but I'm really excited to get going with our guest today. He's just amazing. Oh, he's a dog. I love dogs.
Hey. Save that pillow talk for later in the show. We've got to get to know this fine fellow and his dog. Yes, we are really thrilled. We are super excited. We are overjoyed to be speaking to Daniel Hart. It's getting close to the end of November. Things are going to be thankful for. I am thankful for art. I am thankful for music. And ergo, I am thankful for Daniel Hart. Daniel, welcome to the show. How are you today?
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be here. How am I today? Feeling lucky and tired. And like I should have done more stretching yesterday after my little hike.
Hike. Where do you go? Where do you traverse?
I live in Altadena, which is northeast Los Angeles. It is right next to the San Gabriel Mountain Range and the Angeles Forest. So I have two dogs, one of which is on my lap right now, little Archie and big Daphne. And I usually hit the trail that starts at the end of our street most nights. Well, it's not even night anymore. Most days around 4 o'clock. And then we get home just before it gets dark.
Gotcha. What breed are Archie and Daphne?
Archie is a Chihuahua mix. We think the mix is Shiba Inu, but we don't know. He's a rescue. He was living in a park under a bush when they rescued him. And he likes to bark at everyone. He's very defensive. I think it comes from that like survival of the fittest time of his life, when everything was an enemy. And he's a real scamp. He's such a scavenger scamp. He's the fastest at getting the food that falls on the floor. Daphne is probably like five times as large as Archie, because Daphne is a lab mix. She's a black lab, and the mix seems to be with Great Dane, so even bigger.
Oh, that's huge.
And she's mostly a sweetheart, although she'll just trample right over him. She doesn't even see him. He's so small. But he's, let's say a French fry drops on the floor. Archie's there before it even hits the ground.
It's kind of like the fastest gun in the West routine. Want to see the draw? You want to see it again?
He's the fastest scamp in the West.
Well, great. Federico and I are huge fans. We're going to contain our fanboy excitement just because we're working professionals, as are you. So as we like to do, we like to toss a grapefruit to our guests and just get to know them. Mr. Hart, tell us, what got you into music? What gets you up in the morning? What is the first thing you grab when you have a melody in your heart and you got to get it out?
Got me into music was my parents. I was 3 years old. They took me to my first violin lesson. I didn't want to do it because my older brother was already doing it. And I think I fancied myself independent at three. But the violin teacher, Mrs. Wright, she was really kind and curious. And this is the story that my father tells. I don't actually remember this, but he says that they took me to the violin lesson and I didn't want to be there, but the violin was there. And the teacher, Mrs. Wright, said, "Oh, Daniel, what is that that you brought with you?" And I said, "It's a violin." And she said, "Oh, wow, can I see it?" And so then I took it out of the case and she's like, oh, it's so pretty. Can I see how it looks under your chin? And then I put it under my chin. I mean, that's like, that's some wizard level coaxing right there. Mm-hmm. And apparently once I put it under my chin, it just never left after that. That's what got me into music. My father also says that when I was around that age, or maybe a little bit older, like 4 or 5 years old, I really loved commercial jingles. And so he would sing them to me, like the ones that I liked the best, he would sing them to me even when the commercial wasn't on. And apparently I would correct him, like if the pitch was wrong or if the words were wrong, I would sing it back correctly. Again, I don't know, that could be a father's embellishment, but he says that's what happened. What gets me up in the morning?
Were they musicians as well? Were your parents musicians as well?
My parents are both musicians. They're both retired now. They were church musicians that were, for most of their careers, or educators in music. And they conducted choirs and they played the organ and the piano. And they used to take me on their choir tours sometimes when I was a little kid. So I have like very distinct memories of going around Europe when I was about 5 years old with my father's university choir. And they had these popsicles in Italy where the popsicle stick was this blue plastic, but it was all, you know what I'm talking about, Federico? You're nodding your head like this is familiar.
Yeah, it's a popsicle. Yeah, we have of those in South America. If you blow, it blows like a whistle, right?
Oh, I wish that was the case. No, this yeah. was...
yeah, we have those.
Sounds really cool. No, this was ones where it was blue plastic, and then it had all of these, it had like these teeth, so that you could get popsicle sticks and build things with them.
Like yes, little... like towers.
Yeah, stuff. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we had those, yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I remember that. I remember hating pizza in Italy. It was my favorite food as a five-year-old. And then the pizza, can I use profanity on this podcast?
Fuck yeah.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. I was like, what the fuck is this? What the fuck is this? This isn't pizza. And I remember seeing the Statue of David in Florence. It sounds like we only went to Italy. I feel like we went to a bunch of other places, but all my memories are from Italy. But I remember seeing the Statue of David, and it's just unreal. It's so big. And to a five-year-old, even bigger. And my parents apparently, like, they were worried that my brother and I would laugh because David's naked, so they told us beforehand, like, don't, it's not, he's naked and that kind of could be funny, but don't laugh. And apparently my brother and I were just so awestruck by how big it was, and it's really quite a tremendous work of art. So I think that was a little bit of the beginning of visual art appreciation for me on that trip as well. Along with musical appreciation.
Well, the whole approach to David to begin with was, artisans have a different way of, working in their craft. I think that Michelangelo said that he didn't find David. David was in there the whole time, and he just little by little chipped it away. I'm sure you've heard that before, but how do you approach something?
Yeah, I feel the same way. I feel like the music finds me.
Okay.
There's stuff about me, about who I am, and the way I was raised, and the water I drank, and the commercials that I watched that mean that the music that I make probably all sounds like it came from a specific person. But I feel like that's just my filtering of whatever is showing up, and so. if I'm starting on a film or a TV show or anything, when I'm starting on a project, I have to watch it the first time without any kind of temp or reference music in the cut. And if they let me do that, then whatever I'm watching, if I have any connection to it at all, music just starts showing up in my head to go along with what I'm watching.
Is that even an option? Sorry to interrupt. Is that even an option? Do you know that you could say, hey, I'd like to watch this on mute, or don't give me the temp track, or, you know?
It's been an option. Yeah, most people humor me. Okay. Yeah. And in terms of working with David Lowry on all the films that we've made, we've done the last three films with no temp music, at least at the beginning of the process. Mm-hmm. No temp music. And it's been an incredible journey of exploration with much fewer boundaries. And I feel like it leads to better work from me.
Well, I you have a very interesting backstory, you know, playing the violin at three. I mean, how do you even hold it properly? Do they make tiny violins? Are there less strings?
The three-year-olds that I know in my life now, I don't understand how that was ever possible. But it was a real violin, and apparently I was playing it. I mean, I'm sure it sounded absolutely terrible. Mm-hmm. I've heard recordings of, I gave violin recitals in my parents' house starting at age six, I think. And I've heard recordings of me and my brother as children playing the violin in our parents' house and them accompanying us on the piano. And yeah, it's screechy and scratchy, and I wouldn't want to listen to that. But parents have a way of making us feel like the music that we're making is the best music ever made, even when it's that bad.
Your jokes are great. This cow pie tastes amazing. You wrote a symphony, Daniel. So,
yeah, exactly.
I'm an interior designer, so is my wife. And the last thing that we want our daughter to do, she's six now, is to do what we do. So it's great that as your parents were working professionals, that they encouraged what they do as a, you know, as a viable lifestyle or you know, profession.
It seemed to me like they never approached it that way when we were kids, but they thought that music was so important to the just to the enjoyment of life that they wanted us to have a connection to music, even if it wasn't a professional one. My brother is a history professor, a university history professor. Oh. And he basically stopped playing the violin when he finished high school. He took violin lessons all the way through high school. He played in the high school orchestra, a fairly accomplished violinist for a suburban kid who wasn't going to conservatory. He played really well, but it wasn't his passion, and so he basically stopped. Now he has a daughter, and she's playing the violin as well, and she's been taking lessons for years, and I think he sees it the same way. Like, he doesn't know if she'll do that professionally. He doesn't care. He just thinks music is important.
Well, you started playing the violin when you were 3 years old, and I did a little bit of research on you, and I know that you went to college, but you didn't go to study music. Is that right?
That's true. I don't have a degree in music. I have a degree in playwriting.
Okay. Yeah. Because I remember that when you were saying that you watch films with no score, and I wonder if that background in playwriting actually helped you to form the idea of music around something that has no music from the beginning.
Without a doubt. It's given me this extra leg up, I think, to have not only an interest in dialogue and scripts and plot points, story arcs, character development, but to then actually have some training in how to create those things in the first place. It gives me this extra window into the filmmaking process, I think. I basically don't know anything about the technical side of filmmaking, but about the technical side of storytelling, I do know things. And I think that has helped me whenever I'm working on a project that involves telling any kind of story. It helps me like connect to the material and connect to the characters in a way that I probably wouldn't do as deeply otherwise.
Why is there not a four act structure? Why is it always the third act, the three acts? Is it a Shakespearean thing? He kind of set the bar for everybody. Do they teach you that in playwright school?
That's a great question. I probably did learn the answer to that question in school. If I did, I've forgotten it. Okay. Things seem to come in threes though, like not only in storytelling structures. Three is a very popular number in culture.
Except there's like four Ghostbusters, there's four Horsemen. I don't know, good, bad, or indifferent. Anyway, so I forgot to mention this. I'm a Dallas native. And I interviewed David Lowery for Ain't Them Body Saints. And he had some positive praise because one of the standout elements of Ain't Them Body Saints was the music and the discussions you had with mandolin and the body percussion, the things that really made that a standout element. So he says that when I met Daniel, it was just something that he could just take and run. You know, he kind of had to push you in a couple ways because you weren't familiar with that instrumentation, but he said that the sensibilities that you had in developing that score, he said, when you find somebody like that in your life, you want to hold on to them forever. So
Daniel's one of those amazing collaborators where there is not really a big process at all, because he just gets what the movie needs on a very intuitive level, and he's able to just go off, write a bunch of music, come back, and that music is 90% perfect. And he scored my short film, Pioneer, and this is the first feature he's done. And I knew from the get-go, like with Pioneer, like this is someone who just gets it. He gets it. He knows what I want without me having to explain it. And I'm like, I'm not a musician. I can barely play the piano. And so it's hard for me to communicate to another artist who is an expert at their medium how to get what I want. So if I can find someone like Daniel who is able to, without me even talking to him, just get what the movie needs in such a thorough and amazing fashion, like that's something I'm going to hang on to for the rest of my life. But yeah, the process was, I showed him the script, I said, I think maybe we could use some mandolin and banjo, and obviously you'll use some strings because he's a classically trained violin player, and then he just read the script, watched some footage, and then went off and started writing music and came back and had this amazing score that became the backbone of the movie in a way that I hadn't expected it to be. But it was so perfect and so dynamic that it became central to the movie. Like prior to that, I didn't know how much music would be in it, how big of a part it would play, what the music would sound like, and all of a sudden I realized that this movie is going to have a big streak of music that everything is kind of bound to, and it's going to just be the thing that holds the whole movie together. And that was an amazing discovery to have.
I'm sure you know how much you mean to him, but this is a third party way of saying that you're pretty awesome. So
thank you for sharing that. He and I seem to see things the same way in terms of storytelling, but also in other ways in our lives. And it could absolutely have something to do with growing up in Dallas. My family didn't move to Texas until I was 10 years old. Before that, we were in Kansas. So I'm not a Texas native, but all those formative years I spent in Dallas, and then I went to university in Dallas as well. And then I moved back to Dallas in 2010 and lived there for another 6 years. So I've spent, what is that, almost half my life in Dallas. Okay. And that could be part of it, but I don't know. Like, as soon as I saw his films, when he started sending me stuff, it just felt like very natural to me. Like, oh yeah, I know what to do with this. Mm-hmm. I had never thought about being a film composer, but when I saw those films, I thought, yeah, this makes sense. I know what to do musically when I see these images.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of experimentation? Because one of the things that, if you look at Ain't Them Body Saints, you look at A Ghost Story and The Green Knight, which I'd like to spend a good portion of the interview with Federico and I sharing some questions. It seems like everything has been, you know, you've been reinventing yourself, I would say. It doesn't seem, the music seems like you, but there's some really great elements that you've added to the scores to really give yourself a fully full-faceted resume. So I guess what, you know, working with somebody like David consistently can be helpful because you have a dialogue, but I guess what point in each conversation do you go, let's try something new, pushing your boundaries, try to flex your muscles, so to speak?
We're early enough in our collaboration that David and I seem to be interested in doing that every single time. Will we run out of genres of music to switch up to eventually? I don't know. But I think he's also said somewhere in some interview that part of what he enjoys about making films in a wide array of genres is that he knows it will be a chance for me to do something different musically, or it will like throw me a curveball or give me a new challenge. And I have an interest in and experience with a fairly wide array of genres, musically speaking. I played in this band when I was at university, so yeah, I wasn't a music student, but I became friends with a composition professor, and he had a band called the Doubting Scholars, and we would play coffee houses on the weekend. I was in his band, and we would play coffee houses on the weekends, and he treated the band like a class. And so we would play Irish jigs, and we would play Beach Boys covers and Oingo Boingo and blues and jazz and classical. And so it said, hey, there's no genre. It doesn't matter what people will come and see. And students would show up at these coffee houses, you know, probably about a year or two after we started doing it. We're packed most of the time when we played, mostly with our friends, but still it felt like people will come see this and they'll like this no matter what you're playing. It doesn't matter. It's just that you're like having fun doing it and that you're exploring. And so it gave me this extra musical education that said genre doesn't matter and that you can be interested in lots of different things. And it gave me a little, like, it gave me mini classes in several different styles of music. And ever since then, I've been really passionate about many different kinds of music. And so, for example, when we made Old Man and the Gun in 2018 and I saw that film, I thought, I think this should be a jazz inflected score. And part of that is the images that I saw, but I think part of it is just the fact that because of my musical experiences in high school and college, I became absolutely obsessed with jazz and played a fair amount of jazz at that time. And I love it so much that I'm always looking for excuses to get back to doing more jazz. And I took Old Man and the Gun as an excuse to do some jazz.
Yeah, that had a really good result, huh? Because the film's organically in a jazzy way. I mean, the whole pace of the film, it fits together with the score so good.
I'm really happy with how it turned out. It's very simple jazz. There's nothing complex about it. It feels very basic and modal to me. But it was a real joy to make. We had a jazz piano trio come in and record a bulk of the score, and they knocked it out of the park. Most of the music in the film was their first takes in the studio. It's really,
that's good.
Really fun, easy to make.
And you were talking about different genres and your whole relationship with David Lowery has taken you through different genres. Which one of those genres or one of those, I mean, like scores, was the most challenging for you in order to accomplish as a tool for adding some fuel to the story? Because even though you can compose a score, it has to go well with the movie. Which one was the most challenging for you to fit together with the film that David Lowery was trying to make?
There have been a few different kinds of challenges along the way. The most challenging time that we've had with a score for one of his films was for The Green Knight. A lot of that had to do with him not being happy with the film that he was making until pretty late in the process. And so I would write music for a scene and it wouldn't work because the scene wasn't ready. And it also had to do with my own expectations for what the story was versus what I thought it should be. And so in a scene, like a really big scene where I thought there should be a big orchestral statement musically, it didn't quite line up because this story was a bit slippery, more slippery than we thought it was. It wasn't the film that either of us thought he was making. So there's that complication of just finding music and then having to keep remaking the music as the edit changed. But other complications like Mark mentioned, when we were doing Ain't Them Bodies Saints, the first conversation we had was about instrumentation. And David said, well, I'm hearing mandolins and banjos. And I thought, well, okay, we can do that. I don't play either of those instruments. I don't own them, but I'm happy to try. And so I borrowed a mandolin and a banjo from a friend. And then I've played guitar as well since I was in high school. So it's not that far a stretch. It's not like me trying to learn how to play the bassoon. But yeah, learn how to play those. And then that was the part of that, one of the parts of that score that seems to make the biggest impression on people. And I think at least within the film world gave people the impression that that was the kind of thing that I do all the time, or that that's like my trademark. Because for several years after Ain't Them Bodies Saints came out, the job offers that I got were for mostly independent films, mostly people who had seen Ain't Them Bodies Saints and wanted music like that for their own film. So I spent a lot of time with a mandolin and a banjo that I had never planned to spend in the first place. When we made Pete's Dragon for Disney, the challenges were manyfold. I replaced the original composer, so I only had a couple months to get everything ready, and it's a lot of music. And it was for a full orchestra and a full choir, and I played in a lot of orchestras growing up, but I'd never scored for an ensemble that big before. So that was a real challenge, like getting my skills up to par for that, writing for orchestra. And then trying to be true to the elements of this big Disney movie that didn't need an orchestra, that were more down to earth and felt more like a film like Ain't Them Buddies Saints that had more of a folk instrumentation and feel and convincing myself that that was enough when I felt like we should probably have an orchestra the whole time.
But did you, what I really don't know much about the process for making Pete's Dragon, but I think you replaced Howard Shore, right?
I did.
For that film. Okay. And did you actually had to make huge changes to what he had written before? I mean, did you listen to what he made before?
I've never heard it. I've never heard it. I didn't want to hear it at the time. And David didn't want me to hear it. He didn't want me to be influenced by it. And the reason that he got replaced was it wasn't his vision for what the score should be for the film, and David's vision just weren't the same. So that's another reason for me not to hear it, because David didn't want it to sound like that in the end. And David had tried to convince Disney to hire me in the first place anyway. Like I did audition for the film before they hired Howard Shore, and I wrote a bunch of music for it. And Disney felt like it was too much of a risk. Like I wasn't experienced enough. I didn't have anything on my resume that could convince them that I did know what to do with an orchestra and that I could handle a project as big as this film, because the only feature film that I'd done with David up to that point was Ain't Them Buddies Saints, which is a very different kind of film. And I think I had scored two or three other features by the point that I interviewed for Pete's Dragon. So I understand why they did not hire me in the first place. But when things didn't work out with Howard, David's relationship had changed with Disney to the point where they trusted him more than they could when they first started working with him, because he was also an unknown quantity when he first started making the film. Like he was the risk that they were taking, and they wanted to surround him with people that they knew could do the job. But by the point that it came back to me, David had made a film that the studio really loved. And so when he said, "I really think you should give Daniel a second chance," they were more open to it. And like, ironically, he played them one of the pieces that I had written as an audition the first time. And they were like, "Oh, wow, this is great." So it may be that they just weren't ready to hear it in the first place. But it also may be that they, like me, assumed that this was going to be a giant film and there's going to be a giant orchestra all the time, when in fact the film that ended up being made had these moments that were much more intimate and grounded and down to earth and needed a more subtle touch musically.
Like, I guess it worked, because I don't know, talk a lot about it, but you guys are making Peter Pan and Wendy, so
we are.
It must have worked for you to, you know, to go towards that classic story that you're making right now. Wanted to mention that it's I'm not really into Disney movies, but when Disney movies get to be grounded, such as Pete's Dragon was, it just fills me with excitement, because it's a whole turn of what we usually see in Disney movies.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah, there's an extensive process of feedback that happens on a Disney film, where on Pete's Dragon, I made music for a scene and then I showed it to David, and then he gives me his notes and I work on it until he's happy with it. And then we share it with the producers of the film and they give me notes, and then I work on it until they're happy with it. And then we share it with the head of music at Disney. He gives me notes, and then share it with the vice president of the studio, and then he gives me notes. And then once every couple months, the president of the studio would come in and watch a few things and give me some feedback. So there are a lot of rounds of feedback to go through. But despite all of that, I feel like the music that ended up in the film is basically our initial vision for it. It doesn't feel like it got noted to death. It doesn't feel like it got over Hollywoodized. They basically let us do what we wanted to do, and we felt like we made the thing that we wanted to make. And that feels also antithetical to a big studio experience, or what a big studio experience can be. And because they really, like, financially speaking, I don't think that film did as well as they hoped it would. It still made money. It made a profit, but it wasn't like a big blockbuster. But there was a sense, I think, for the studio that this Pete's Dragon that we made was, in some ways, it was like a callback to the kinds of children's action adventure films that Disney had made a few decades before, and felt more like those, and they wanted another one of those, I think. And so Peter Pan also feels to me like it doesn't so much resemble more of the modern bigger films, and feels more like a throwback to me, to like the children's action adventure films that I loved as a kid. Feels kind of like Goonies to me.
Okay. Well, what else? Because you know, everybody has their sort of holy grail when it comes to action adventure kids movies, or things that really cemented themselves in somebody's eyes and brain. What else did you grow up liking?
I really loved Pee-wee's Big Adventure. So much. It was one of the first films, I think, where the music, the score, really made an impression on me. And I listened to the score last year after not having seen the film or having listened to the score for, I don't know, at least 8 or 9 years. And it's still in there. It's in my brain. I remember it very clearly. So it got in there for sure. I really loved The Princess Bride when I was a child too. That felt like a real action adventure to me. And so funny, at least to a kid. I loved Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Actually, I watched it once when I was like 9 years old, and I thought it was the dumbest thing I'd ever seen. And then I watched it again when I was 11. I was like, this is pure, pure genius.
Yeah.
E.T. Yeah. E.T., Back to the Future. I did also really like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom when I was a child. I thought it was terrifying. The pulling the heart out of the chest.
Yeah.
I think it gave me nightmares. I was so captivated by that idea that that could even be possible.
Yeah, I watched that a bunch on cable when I was a kid, and a bunch of movies that I shouldn't have as a kid, but there's something about, maybe it's a Spielberg movie, maybe it's about any movie in general, but if it kind of ends happy, it kind of gets you through those rough patches, you know? It's like, maybe we step on fortune cookies, but like, you know, for every guy that falls off into lava or off of a train car, the fact that they just, you know, it's a happy ending, kind of smooths it over. That's something I always kind of thought at when I was a kid. Maybe kept me from having nightmares.
I think the fact that in E.T., his mother is divorced, and it's clear from the beginning that she's having a hard time raising these boys on her own. That's right, isn't it? That's the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It makes it feel much more real. It makes it feel a little bit scarier when when the alien shows up than I think it would if everything was happy the whole time.
That's a very valid point.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah. There's that one scene where he first meets E.T. and he's on the fold-out chair in his backyard, and he can't even get the words out. He's, "Oh, Michael." Like, I'm sure we've all been in that situation where it's like it's paralyzed by what's going on.
Yeah.
Luckily, he was benevolent, but could have been the other way.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a novel called God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. There's a thing that she writes about in the novel, which follows a brother and sister from childhood into adulthood, and all the terrible things that happen to them and around them in Southwest India. And there's this one scene where she describes the boy going to the bathroom to pee and like trying to hit the little wafer in the bottom of the urinal with his urine.
Mm-hmm.
Like the little cake, the little urine cake with his urine. And I thought, man, that is some attention to childlike detail right there.
Fair enough.
That I would never have ever thought to include that detail in my story. That's why she's a brilliant writer.
Yeah.
And I'm not.
Well, I think you chose your profession wisely, which is why we're enjoying this conversation today. So speaking of small details, speaking of benevolence, speaking of all things great, The Green Knight, man, I don't know where to start. I don't know why I loved it, but I loved it. And while it's great that it was inspired by a poem and it became like, it felt like walking or living poetry, which speaks both to the cinematography and the music. But I mean, like, to quote the comic book guy from The Simpsons, worst Christmas movie ever. But what was that? Some of the, I gotta know, what were some of the first conversations you had? What did you want to achieve? And more to that point, you said the movie wasn't working after a certain point. Can you tell us, you know, what was not manifesting on screen?
The first conversation we had was about instrumentation, again, usually the case. And the music in the film is basically it's like the checklist of all the instruments that we talked about using. So a recorder quartet, this Swedish medieval stringed instrument called a nickel harpa, a prophet synth, a choir. That at least we got right from the beginning. We had ideas about what it should be, and then those turned out to be true in terms of the instrumentation. And then the first piece of music that I wrote for the film was a lullaby to be sung on camera. One of Gawain's sisters sings it while a woman's giving birth in the film. And so that started my exploration of Middle English poetry. I hadn't really studied it before then. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about that version of English. And so I watched a lot of YouTube videos of people reciting Middle English poetry, people who seemed to know how to pronounce that language. And I read a lot of Middle English poetry and started making myself a little dictionary of the words that I liked the best because of the way that they sounded or the way that they were spelled and the difference between that and modern English. And then I wrote this song called O Nigthagala. And Nigthagala is nightingale in Middle English, but the difference between those two words, Nigthagala, nightingale, was so fascinating to me that I felt like I had to use that word So yeah, this lullaby called Old Nyctagala is what ended up in the films with what the actor Athena Frizzell sang on camera, and then a whole chunk, big chunk of score was made around that song later on. The troubles that we had. Yeah, so there's a scene where Gawain is wandering in the wilderness and he encounters a bunch of giants, a tribe of giants walking across this desert. And it felt to me like this needs to be the biggest music in the film, just in terms of the arrangement. It needs to be like huge to match the size of these people. And I wrote a really big orchestral cue for that scene, and it just didn't work. Like, as I was working on it, I was like, I don't know if I can pull this off. And then I finished it and I listened back and I was like, that's like 90% right, I think, but it doesn't really work. And I sent it to David anyway, because that was as far as I could get before I needed someone else to tell me like what was good about it and what was not. And he felt the same way. He was like, yeah, this should work. Like, on paper, what you wrote seems like the right thing for this scene. But as we learned from the film over and over again, what we thought should work didn't feel right. And so he suggested that I write a song for that scene instead. I've written a lot of songs over my musical life. I have my own band for which I'm the songwriter and singer. And so it didn't seem like a great challenge to try and write a song for a scene, but it did feel to me when I started like it's just not going to be big enough. That's how it felt to me. And I think the trick in that scene, as it turned out to be in so many scenes, was that making it bigger doesn't make it right, even if it feels like a really big moment. And so I wrote a song for that scene, and that's the song that ended up in the film. And that, I think, was the first moment where David really felt like, now we've found something that we're looking for, even though I'd probably already written 30 or 40 minutes of score by then.
Well, I heard a quote from John Williams, and I'm picking a paraphrase here, but it's something like, inspiration doesn't just come like a bolt out of the blue. It's usually at the 11th hour through a whole lot of effort and trying on the sixth day. And so it's like, sometimes your best answer is not, you know, the right answer. So you do need to craft it, try something different. And it's the alchemy. But so would you describe this as a horror movie? It's tough to pigeonhole anything, or you shouldn't pigeonhole anything, but if you could sort of encapsulate something, what was your mindset with, I mean, you've got like, you know, you've got some droning and whooshing, you've got some, you know, chants and wails and some screechy fiddles, the nickel harpa, like you mentioned. So I guess, can you label this movie?
We had labeled it a medieval fantasy when we started working on it. I never thought of it as a horror film. I didn't approach it as a work of horror. I don't know. Is The Witch a horror film? It's very scary. But
yes.
There are things about it that don't necessarily feel like a horror film to me. The Shining does not feel like a horror film to me either. So it's a horror film as much as it has some conventions of horror, but it's not like, not a lot of jump scares. There's not a direct villain or enemy or monster coming to get him. Like, he's going towards his own possible death.
That's fair.
Reluctantly, yeah. But willingly. So that doesn't feel like a horror film to me.
Well, maybe I leaned in too much towards Katie Dickey, who was also in The Witch and who was also in Prometheus, ergo, ipso facto. They're all kind of horror. I made an assumption.
So. Yeah, horror adjacent. Kate Dickey is such a brilliant actor. I got to score a couple scenes that she was in. I was just, all the whole time I was like, gosh, can't she be on screen just a little longer?
It doesn't feel like a horror film to me, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't have some scenes that like creep me out. And
sure.
But I think that the term medieval horror may apply to some part of the film, but then it has like the third act of the film. And that has a track that's called the Blum Sweet Lily Flower. I wanted to ask about that specific song. First, if it was you singing that, and it's medieval, it's melodic, it's heartbreaking, and I wanted to know at which point of the film did you compose that specific track? Because it's beautiful, it's engaging, but it's haunting in the last part of the film.
It is me singing.
Congrats.
Thank you. I think we thought that I would just sing the demo, and then we started looking for someone to replace me. Like, the idea was always to have someone else sing it, but we never did. We never replaced it. we were happy enough with the. I was happy enough with my vocal performance to use it. And I wrote it pretty late in the process, like maybe a couple weeks before we went to record the music for the film. It was another scenario where a more epic kind of orchestral montage that I had written wasn't working. And because we tried it once and it worked, David was like, well, how about we put a song here? So I wrote that song pretty quickly because we were so far along in the process. I felt like I knew all the structure that I needed with the kind of song that needed to go there. I had already spent a lot of time working in Middle English, so I didn't have to look up a bunch of words in order to write the lyrics. The one thing that I did look up was I tried to find out if there was like a cemetery that would have existed then that people would have known the name of for the lyrics of the song, because it's a song about dying or being remembered after you're dead, and St. Mary's was like the closest I could get to a cemetery in London that might have been there at the time, that might have been well known enough to be referenced in some song lyrics. Yeah, it came really quickly. It was pretty easy to make compared to the rest of the score. And I don't know if that was my first vocal take, probably not, but within the first couple vocal takes.
Well, it sounded great. I mean, it marked the third act for me. I mean, just hearing that song while he was trying to digest a possible outcome for him, it just felt very like heartbreaking, but at the same time it was trying to recognize a version of his future that he maybe was supposed to have but was like refusing to have. I mean, it just worked for me, and that was you singing, man. It was just great. Congratulations for that.
Thanks. I don't think when we were making it at the time, it didn't feel like a necessarily standout moment to me. It just felt like the thing that needed to be there to keep telling the story, to keep the film in the right place. But I'm really happy that it seems to like resonate with people. I really still like listening to it. I don't always like listening to my own voice, but I can still listen to that song for now.
Well, we don't like your voice either. What we're gonna do is we're gonna cut all your parts out. So it's gonna look like a Q&A with me and Federico, and it'll be the most boring interview ever. No.
Couldn't you just replace my voice? Like replace me with Meatwad or something? Yeah.
We'll find comic book guy.
Okay.
Well, you know, inspiration can hit at very weird places. Where do you find most of your inspiration?
The picture itself usually tells me a large chunk of the information that I need to find the music that the scene wants for itself. So there's that inspiration. If I'm working on something and I'm stuck, usually going for a walk, and most of my walks these days are walking the dogs, usually going for a walk with Archie and Daphne will unclog whatever is clogged. So I do find a lot of music on walks. Hikes even more so, like if I'm gone for longer and my mind can wander because I'm doing this thing away from people and noise, other noises, then I can get even further in my head and work on music more extensively. So yeah, walks and hikes are big. If I'm in the middle of a project or getting towards a deadline, it's clear that I was working on the music while I was sleeping, because I'll wake up with the music going in my brain. So yeah, sleeping, working while I'm sleeping helps a lot. But then yeah, I'll also like listen to other music if I'm looking for something or looking to avoid something or making sure that I'm not plagiarizing.
Yeah.
Then I'll listen to other music. And again, because of my interest in a wide variety of genres, that music doesn't always come from a place that is related to the music that I'm working on. But I have been listening to a lot of film scores from the 80s lately as I'm working on Peter Pan. When I was working on The Green Knight, there were not a lot of film scores that I was trying to reference or avoid. So it mostly was not film music. I listened to a lot of medieval music. I listened to a lot of contemporary recorder music. There's a Dutch composer named Michel Mensing who is writing experimental music for recorders in the 21st century. That is where I drew a lot of inspiration for the more extended technique recorder stuff in The Green Knight, like all the squawks and the jitters and the wails that are done on the recorders.
Is a flageolet, that's in the same family as a recorder or a piccolo. Is that right?
A flageolet? I don't know. What is a flageolet? Is that a medieval instrument that I should know?
It may not be medieval. I think it's just a simple wood, very, very simple wood instrument. But it's a sidebar here.
Is a woodwind instrument, a member of the fiddle flute family.
I was talking to Howard Blake, famous British composer, and he had some experience with that at a young age, which is kind of where that instrument stops for a lot of people at like maybe the third grade level, and then you find something a little more advanced. But certainly every instrument has its place, as do the questions in this question and answer period. We don't want to keep you anymore. Before I have one or two fun questions to sort of round this out. But Federico, would you like to ask Mr. Hart any questions, things you want to know?
I'm not going to ask him anything else. I just want to mention that the score for Light of My Life, it's my favorite score in the past decade.
Oh, wow. Thank you, Federico.
Yeah, I mean, the film was awesome for me. But then I remember listening to the score again and again and again, and it brought me back to the emotional connection of the film, which not every score does for me. And it made an impression on me like Johan Johansson's scores made on me. He was great. And I just wanted to mention that the score for Light of My Life just reminded me a lot of what I felt when I was listening to him. And that's my favorite score. I'm sorry, I just have to say it. There's a specific track that I just keep listening to over and over when I'm trying to write about movies. And that doesn't happen very often. And I just wanted to say congrats again on that, because I mean, it's remarkable.
Thank you. There are parts of that score that really remind me of Johan. I wasn't listening to a lot of his stuff at the time, and no one asked me to make music that sounds like him. But I really like his music. So it showed up, you know. It seemed like the thing that worked for the film. It was a really hard one to make. It was a film that I did watch for the first time without any temp music, and an entire score showed up in my head while I was watching it, and I was really excited about what that could be. But I started working on it, and Casey, the director, he didn't like it. It wasn't what he had in mind for his film, so then I had to completely shift gears and start over from scratch. And that's the score that's in there is like round two or round three.
It worked a lot, yeah. Go ahead, Mark.
When you were writing A Block of Ice at the Bottom of the Ocean, did anybody do some research to let you know that ice doesn't sink? Sorry, just had to throw that in there.
Yeah,
that's my favorite track, man.
It's a line from the film. Most of my tracks are named after dialogue, I think, because dialogue means so much to me. Like, it really sticks in my brain and is really a big influence on the score that I write. So yeah, a line from the film. Nobody did that research. They didn't have that oceanographer / chemist / biologist on this.
Neither did Stephen Sommers when he did G.I. Joe Rise of Cobra, because that was, amongst a lot of other things, ice sinking after underwater. Terrible movie, but I kind of like it. There is one line in The Green Knight that I just wanted to bring to the social awareness. Anyone who hasn't seen this, there's a part where it's Joel Edgerton he's in this castle with Alicia Vikander, and he says, "That is the world. And the world is fit for all manner of mysteries." And I think that's just such a beautiful line, because it just shows sort of how nebulous everything is. Then you think of like Ghost Story, you know, there's parts of it that are so like, what's the point of it all? There's a monologue in the middle of the movie talking about the futility of life. And it's like, and all this comes out of the mind of David Lowery, which is just phenomenal. Working with him inspires you to make beautiful art together. So this has been a treat. Anyone who hasn't seen The Green Knight, go out and see it. A couple fun questions for you. Let's say you get done with a cue. Let's say you get done with an entire writing of the score. What's your victory dance? What do you do to celebrate? What's your walking on sunshine thing that you do?
There's a place in Studio City called Fata Morgana Gelato that has like 20 vegan flavors of gelato, among like so many others. And the entire place is also gluten-free. Like all their waffle cones and things are also vegan and gluten-free. And usually I'll go there. They have a tamarind gelato that is something else. I mean, the lemon is great, and they have one called El Pensiero that is grapefruit and ginger and lemon peel. That's also really fantastic, and a hazelnut. Anyway, yeah, go and get gelato. I don't know, when we finished scoring The Green Knight, which we did at Air Studios in London, my partner Rachel and I went to Wales for a couple of days, and we stayed at an Airbnb that was kind of close to where anyone who might be the person that King Arthur is based on would have lived. So anything Arthurian could have taken place in this part of Wales. We went there, we did some hiking, we walked around, ate a bunch of food. I don't know what I'll do when I finish Peter Pan. I'll probably collapse.
I imagine scoring takes a lot of energy out of you, but
yeah, victory collapse.
Well, very last question. There was a meme a couple years ago that it was an infographic that said, you know, what my friends think I do, what my parents think I do, what I actually do. So if you could break down what composing is in this day and age and what you actually do versus the perception.
It's a lot of me sitting in this room in my little home studio. And I'm surrounded by instruments. A lot of stringed instruments, since that's my training. So violin and viola and stuff like the nickel harp I didn't have before The Green Knight, but I have it now. And I got a contrabass recorder that I also did not have before The Green Knight that I have now. And a lot of drums, which you can kind of see in the background behind me. I'll sit in this room. I'll play an instrument depending on what the score is calling for. It would probably either be violin or piano to start. And I'll mess around until I come up with something that I like, that feels like the thing that I'm looking at. And then I spend several hours making all the layers that I want to make with different instruments, whether that's actually me recording myself or me making something that will eventually be recorded by someone else. I'm still like spending time adding all those layers in. And then eventually, usually, I go somewhere else at the very end of it to record a bunch of other people. And I sit in a control booth at a recording studio and say, yes, that sounds right. No, that's a bit out of tune. This needs to be played in a different, slightly different rhythm. Or I wrote the wrong note here. We need to change this note. In a pandemic, almost all that still happens here in my studio via Zoom. And so I'm looking at an orchestra or any kind of ensemble recording somewhere else, and I'm just here. But I guess the main answer to your question is I just sit in this room. I sit in this room for inordinate amounts of time not getting enough sunlight and not stretching my legs as much as I should. And I stare at a computer screen and think about music. That's mostly it.
So you're telling me you left Dallas to go to LA to do what you could have done by sitting in Dallas to do the stuff that you do in LA? Come back home, Daniel. Come back home. Hang out with us. Well, this has been a real treat. As I said, Federico and I are big fans, and the big takeaway from this this session to take a cue from Light of My Life is listen to your inside voice, which is another way of saying you trust your instincts, and your instincts make the world a better place. Thank you immensely for being on the show today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you both, Mark, Federico. Great to talk to you.
Thank you, Daniel. Yeah, same here.